Assalamu alaikum, my name is Salim Qasim, I'm the chief editor of the Muslim Vibe and your host for this week's podcast. This week we're talking about the Islamic Human Rights Commission and their work as a human rights NGO over the last 21 years. I'm joined this week by Arzu Mirali. Arzu Mirali is a writer and researcher based in London. She's one of the co-founders of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, or IHRC, and recently authored a research paper on dominant counter-narratives to Islamophobia co-funded by the Rights, Equality and Citizenship Programme of the European Union. Before we get underway, here's a quick word from our sponsor, Wahed Invest.
Wahed helps you become a halal investor in minutes. Clients from over 40 states have already started their journey with us. Here's how it works. First, we ask you 8 simple questions to recommend a portfolio based on your risk profile. You then select your portfolio and simply sign up online. Your account can be approved in seconds. After you fund your account, we'll place the trades for you. All you have to do then is sit back and monitor your performance. It actually is that easy.
So yeah, assalamu alaikum. Thank you, Arzu, for joining us today.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me on.
It's not a problem. So I think the first question is regarding IHRC and also yourself and your role in founding or forming IHRC. Where did the idea come from and how did it all come together?
Where to start? Okay, so IHRC has been around for 21 years. It's actually just gone past our anniversary. And we were a group of activists who came from different backgrounds. I was a journalist at the time. I had a little bit of legal training. Some of my colleagues of the founders, you know, they were working on issues around Nigeria, things that were happening in terms of persecution of the Islamic movement. I myself and some others were involved in documenting war crimes in Bosnia. I mean, that was just a recently finished conflict at that time. Mm. And actually, sadly, even till this day, there's a lot of unfinished business with regard to that.
Yeah.
And there were other people who've been working in race relations for a long time in this country who were, you know, basically grassroots advocates, things like this, caseworkers. Mm. And I think, you know, we all kind of knew each other. Some of us were working in the same now kind of effectively defunct Muslim organization. And we just felt that we were not really kind of utilizing the resources that were at hand properly. The fact that when you work in the human rights field, I mean, even then, this is obviously before 9/11 and all this kind of heightened tension that we've had for nearly two decades, it was still a kind of anti-Muslim time in different ways. So in the human rights arena, you would find that people would perceive Islam to be a barrier to human rights and justice. And the fact that even though about 80% of the kind of really severe human rights abuses around the world were probably against Muslims, this is, you know, United Nations figures, this wasn't kind of conceptualized in a kind of rational way, if you like, within that community. It was almost as if they were victims of their own identity, rather than you know, victims of wider forces, whether they were kind of post-colonial, colonial things, or anything else. And we felt, okay, we want to actually make a statement, hence the name Islamic Human Rights Commission. We had quite a lot of fights over it. I was against it, but I think I
was against the name.
I was against the name, but I think I was proven wrong quite rapidly. Because we wanted to be in your face and say, look, we're coming from an Islamic perspective here. We weren't being prescriptive. We were quite a broad kind of range of Muslim backgrounds.
Yeah.
And that's what inspires us. And we're here doing this for everybody. It's not even particularly just for Muslims, although ultimately most of the work we do is kind of has got a Muslim focus.
Yeah.
And here we are, lump it or like it. And actually, as many people who kind of lump it also like it. So it's been...
I think there's two questions I've got here. So, firstly, how would you, in a sentence or two, define the Islamic Human Rights Commission if someone asks you kind of off the street?
Sure.
I think let's start with that, and then I've got my second question, otherwise it'll get a bit confusing.
So the pat answer is, we're a campaign research and advocacy organisation. We have developed over the years, so we are now recognised at the level of the United Nations. We have consultative status with the ECOSOC there. We have a presence in Brussels at the European Union and European institutional level.
Yeah.
We've been funded by the EU for a joint project with the University of Leeds and several other universities and so on and so forth. So we are a human rights NGO, but we have different facets to that.
And my second question was how you get from a bunch of people who share an ideology or who share a vision to the place that you're at now, 21 years later, number one, still in the field doing the work, and also, you know, working alongside, being an accredited NGO, and working with the EU and being at that kind of top level, how does that come about? Because I think what I've seen at least is that through the work that I've done with the Muslim Vibe, I have a lot of conversations with people working with different organizations with ideas and whatever else, and very few unfortunately make it to that point where they kind of establish themselves. Like when we started out with the Muslim Vibe and we were telling people about it, a lot of people were like, yeah, great, but good luck, not thinking we'd be here kind of 4 years later, bigger than ever before and kind of constantly growing and evolving so much. How do you actually, I guess, actualize the dream and the vision?
I'm not sure we've actualized the dream still, and I think it's a work in progress. I think firstly we have to say, I mean, obviously we're believers and that, you know, it's the barakah that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts into it and nothing else. But I think there are many different things that are going on. I think one of the very unique things at the beginning of IHRC and all the way through is the kind of diversity we had. So people came together simply because they kind of believed broadly in what we were doing.
Yeah.
Out of our founders, two were Bosnian, one was Malaysian, two were Iranian. I myself am a Khawaja, I've got South Asian heritage. There were others as well. You know, I can't kind of list all of them. And Nigerian as well, I should say. Actually, one of the very formative influences on us was Maulana Ibrahim Zakzaki, in a way. Without him, we wouldn't have been where we are now. And I think that kind of, the fact that that's what binds people is what's kept it going. And ultimately, also, there's an awful lot of sacrifice involved. I mean, we started on literally nothing. People were coming in and donating stamps. We still have a bit of pink paper. Someone donated a kind
donating stamps?
Stamps, paper clips. You know, people came in to sort of...
Oh, just... Started.
Yeah,
okay,
exactly. As well as, obviously, you know, a bit of cash here and there.
Yeah.
But we literally started on a dream rather than with, you know, a budget for the year.
Yeah.
And as I was just saying, we recently found, you know, there was a little bit of that pink paper left that somebody had donated because it was never, ever appropriate to use for very much. And we're quite sentimental about it, to be honest. You know, it's kind of a memento. But ultimately, I think that is one of the great strengths. We started very small and we built up.
Did you have an office in the early days?
We started off on someone's kitchen table, which developed after a year or less than a year into, because he moved into his dining room.
Yeah.
That was one of the co-founders who then we got married and we bought a place and that then became our garage. And then we went into IHRC only premises. That took us, let's see, it was 2003, so 6 years to get to our own premises.
Wow.
And we are now, we have a kind of, you know, high street frontage. We've got a bookshop in front of our offices,
yeah,
etc. That's been since 2011. So we're looking at 7 years.
So for the first 6 years, IHRC didn't have an office or a base. It was just...
First 2 years, definitely. Because our garage was kind of split off and had a different entrance and, you know, its own bathroom and everything. I like
to think it
had its own kind of identity.
Talking about technicalities now.
Yeah.
But...
But put it this way, you know, I could close the door and the office would run and I would have my own life, in theory.
That's amazing. I mean, I think even, like, funny enough, my own business that I started, mm-hmm, started off in a bedroom. And myself and Haseeb would meet once a week and we'd kind of sit down and have our laptops and just kind of be working on a little table. And then you slowly kind of grow and evolve. And I think what people underestimate often is that it's never pretty.
Mm.
The early days are never, it's never like the glitz and glam of a few years down the line after you've done all the hard work. And people don't want to do that. They just want to see the end result. So I think definitely, you know, huge amount of credit to you and to the team for kind of keeping the dream alive for 21 years. You might not be there yet.
But, you know, I think that's actually something we don't realise. This is not particularly even a Muslim thing. Amnesty started on someone's kitchen table or,
yeah,
I don't know, drawing room table or whatever it was, maybe slightly more upper class than we were. But and then, you know, Oxfam, all of these guys started in very, very small places. And I think we live in an age where everyone is kind of obsessed with having to have the funding in place, the budget in place, the look has to be right.
Yeah.
Actually, it's the substance that matters, you know, the quality of the work and obviously... from our point of view, the right intention.
No, I think I completely agree with that.
Inshallah, I hope it's accepted as the right intention.
Of course, no, of course, that's the thing. I mean, I've always seen that things that I've seen to do well I firmly believe that, that God has a part to play in them, because everyone, I mean, there's a million and one ideas for projects and for businesses and whatever else, but only with kind of God's blessing will you actually be able to succeed. And sometimes great ideas have gone down the drain, and I can't sort of ascribe sort of fault on anyone else. Not fault, but you know what I mean. Like, there is
exactly.
There is definitely that element to it. Coming back to IHRC, what would you say have been the kind of the highlights for you over the last 21 years? Your proudest moments.
Proudest moments. I don't know. I think I'm.
Or biggest wins.
See, I'm the misery gut, so I always find something a fault in everything. I'm absolutely notorious for this. I think, I mean, this doesn't in and of itself sound like a very kind of huge thing, but I think the fact that we've had such a diversity of people working within IHRC, and you know, we're unable to kind of pay the flash money, etc., yeah, because our idea is better to be independent of government funding, wherever that government is, right? So it really is a labour of love if you work at IHRC, and you know, we're based in London, so that's not cheap for anybody. And the fact that, you know, so many people have come through the doors, quite a lot of whom have stayed. I mean, a lot of our managers and trustees and directors started as interns, okay? So, you know, it's nice to see some people grow within the organisation, some people go out, get another job, come back to IHRC after a while. And other people go on and do, you know, stuff in the United Nations and other kind of places. They work in the private sector or private law, etc. Yeah. But you feel like, you know, okay, you've helped people grow and go out there. And one of the things about IHRC, which often gets us into a lot of trouble, makes us controversial, is that we're a little bit in your face about a lot of things. And I think for us, it was about building confidence in communities that have historically and even increasingly recently been really kind of oppressed and really been made to feel that they can't express themselves, that they can't show what they believe in or kind of allow that to guide them in their everyday life.
When you say in your face, what kind of campaigns have you been at the forefront of that has been quite provocative?
Well, I think right from the start, actually, we were involved in campaigning against anti-terrorism laws. And I mean, the last round of them started in the United Kingdom in 1997. And it was part of a kind of Europe-wide move to actually sort of strengthen up the security apparatus of the states involved. And it was done quite surreptitiously to begin with. I mean, it kind of became much more acceptable and open after 9/11.
I was quite young in 1997. So I have a question.
I'm 47. I hold my hand on it.
I was 7 at the time. So with, you mentioned that anti-terror laws were kind of expanding, I'm assuming, in 1997.
Essentially, we had one lot which covered the period of the so-called Troubles in the north of Ireland.
Okay.
They had been repealed, but very soon after, new ones came in, which in practice were targeting Muslims, particularly sort of in the late 90s were targeting the North African community.
So my question to you is why? Because I've always understood the narrative around Muslims as being shaped by 9/11. And that could be just pure naivety, because again, I was, I think, 11 at the time. But that's how I understood the world. There was a kind of a pre-9/11 world and a post-9/11 world, which is, I think, how people generally define policy and everything else. But what was the need to kind of, let's say, vilify Muslims through anti-terror laws in 1997?
I'm not sure that there was such a pressing need as obviously subsequent, but you know, it obviously fits into a lot of foreign policy agendas and the kind of mass machinations at the kind of diplomatic and international political level. I mean, it doesn't matter that at that time there was a new Labour government who, you know, gave a press conference saying they were going to have an ethical foreign policy. I remember watching that at the time, and a lot of journalists, they all burst out laughing when Robin Cook said that. I mean, it was kind of ridiculous to think
really
that any government in this country would have an ethical foreign policy. It's just not, forget about heard of, how is it even possible, given the way that Britain, you know, places itself in the world. But indeed it was there. And I think, you know, in some ways there was it was a kind of testing ground for things to come. I think we kind of live in I think we've sometimes, you know, bought the story about how wonderful the United Kingdom is in terms of its values and its history and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's never been as liberal or open as people think. And that's the same for most westernised nations. You know, when it's not under a lot of stress, even then, it has been quite restrictive. It might be against people with left-wing ideas, it might be people with quote-unquote Islamic political ideas. It depends who they're targeting, but there's always kind of been a target. It's almost a facet of how westernized states work. They work against creating another. And so, you know, a space opened up. I mean, a lot of people have discussed about how after the fall of the Soviet Union, that space opened up to demonize then Muslims and kind of nascent Islamic political projects, because there was a lot of that happening.
But why do you think that is? Because I used to believe in like a global conspiracy against Muslims. It was a sort of younger version of myself. I just thought like everyone's out to get us. But over time, and I think things like Trump coming into power in the US has actually really changed the way I've seen things, because the way I understood it was that America was like smiling to our face, but then shooting us behind, you know, behind closed doors kind of thing. Whereas, and that's probably the option that Hillary would have given us. But with Trump, he's saying it and doing it.
It's perversely refreshing, isn't it?
It's hugely refreshing. I love it. I mean, it's you can't have someone who says Islam hates us as the president of the US, yet that's exactly what we've got. And I think it's amazing, because it's like we know what we're up against. And we've seen with Steve Bannon and with everything else, like we're very much aware of what they're thinking, because he tweets it every day. And that's the most nice thing. Whereas what we've had in the past is this kind of Obama, for example, saying that I'm going to open my arms to the Middle East. And I remember when he came in, I was watching his inauguration, and in his speech he mentioned the Middle East and that he was going to extend a hand out. And I thought, this is great. Like, this is the start of something new. But obviously, what we saw over the years was just like drone strikes and.
He was much worse than Bush, actually, with the drone strikes.
Statistically, yes, that's the thing. I think a lot of people forget that, because he was so charismatic and because he was from a minority background. But coming back to the point I was making originally, that I've shifted away from this. So why? Well, I mean,
I think we have to sort of. I mean, it's about understanding the problem right this minute. I don't know when this is going to be broadcast, but we're going out through the 25th anniversary of the murder of Stephen Lawrence, and there's been some documentaries on, and there have been great reminders about how we had a moment of understanding about structural racism and institutional racism.
Yeah.
And we need to kind of place what that is within the wider history of the world we're living in. And if we kind of look at the kind of modern moment starting around 1492, and you're looking at kind of how Western Europe in particular developed its, you know, went around colonizing the world. Albeit we're supposedly living in a post-colonial moment, but actually economically and even politically speaking, there really hasn't been liberation. There's been nominal independence, but there hasn't actually been liberation for peoples around the world.
Also bigger than that is also like the mentality. We still live in like, there's still colonized minds.
Absolutely.
Everywhere we go on both sides.
Mm.
I think that until that changes, until the mindset of individuals changes, we're not going to see any progress in that way.
Exactly. So if we are still kind of not able to unpack that, and you know, that whole moment, that kind of development of the modern world came off of the back of genocide, essentially. You know, it started with genocide against Muslims and Jews in Spain. It continued with indigenous peoples in the so-called New World. Actually, you know, it wasn't new for anyone except for Columbus and crew.
Yeah.
Right. And then it then extended to the transatlantic slave trade. Okay, so it doesn't mean that terrible things weren't done by different peoples around the world before that or even subsequently, but actually the modern world is based on this. It's based on these genocides. Actually, a friend and colleague, Ramon Grossfogel, actually says there are 4 genocides that underpin modernity. The 3 that I've mentioned, plus the genocide of women who are accused of being witches in Western Europe, which essentially set up this kind of racist patriarchal society that we live in. Put within that the fact that a lot of the ways this is done is through anti-Muslim rhetoric, okay, and kind of anti-black, anti-Muslim narratives have always kind of fed into each other. You know, at the time, the understanding of blackness was also the understanding of Muslimness, okay, the Moor in the European imagination. So we're still living through that, albeit subtly, but it's embedded in the culture, it's embedded in the institutions that we live in. So it's not a global conspiracy, everyone's not out to get us, it's just that all of us, including ourselves, have internalized this. And therefore, you will always be getting policies and strategies that somehow are otherizing people. Currently, we've got a story going on about the Windrush generation in this country. it's not ostensibly tied to anti-Muslim racism, but actually they feed into each other very much. It's the same processes of demonization, of dehumanization. I mean, the way these people have been treated is beyond appalling.
Yeah.
It's absolutely beyond appalling.
I think also considering their history and the service that they gave this government and this country and the people, and obviously, you know, there is, I think there's still this element, and I think James O'Brien was talking about this on the radio a few days ago, where he was just talking about the fact that there is still this kind of class system in terms of earning your stripes in this country and who's more legitimate in terms of being here. And I think ultimately race has a big part to play in that. And being white-skinned ultimately puts you at the top of the pile. And then everyone else, regardless of your history and what you've done, if you've served this country or whatever else, you're just lower down in the order.
It is, but there's also the issue and the idea that why is it that some people have to prove themselves to be worthy? And, you know, whether you're a Windrush generation, you're a Muslim, you're this, you're that or the other, surely the whole point of equality and equal citizenship and equality and humanity is that, well, okay, some of us are miserable so-and-so, some of us are criminals, and some of us are, you know, saints and heroes. It's, you know, either it's got to be the same for everyone, or, you know, at least be honest and say, well, okay, officially you're a second-class citizen, and at some point, frankly, we might just throw you out, even though you're British.
Yeah.
You know, all of these generations we're talking about came to this country with British passports.
But then I think at the same time, we've, you know, as we said earlier, we've then fed into that mentality where we're constantly trying to prove ourselves, and we're constantly trying to be good, and like, be like, oh, look, we're model citizens. And there's this notion, I think, that comes probably from an older generation than my own, where because they've come as immigrants, you know, most of the people here, I think, are second, third generation immigrants, at least the Muslims in this country, from kind of Southeast Asia and wherever else. I think that there's this impression that we need to impress and we need to be good and we need to give back to be accepted and to be loved and to be tolerated. And tolerated is probably the right word for it. Like, that's all we're going to get, and that's all we're striving for. And then you've got sort of my generation and below, where we're born in this country, we feel entitled to be equal. But structurally, there still isn't that acceptance that we are.
It's interesting the way you're characterising it, because I kind of, I agree with you, but then I also think that one of the things that's really troubling for me is that I'm seeing a generation grow up now, which is maybe fourth, fifth, even sixth generation, which is talking like the first generations. And I actually understand why first generations would think like this. Okay, they have some kind of pressing reasons because of the way they've arrived, their history, etc., etc.
Yeah.
I'm second generation, so and I'm a fair bit older than you. And yeah, our generation grew up in the 70s and 80s, and we were kind of carrying on the good fight. And at that time, particularly up to the mid-80s, end of the 80s, there was, I mean, really kind of organised street racism, even in places like London, North London, where I was born and grew up. It was like homeland of the National Front, okay? And we went through the 90s where we thought that had kind of gone away. I think we also believed the hype, you know, because things started, it felt like it was getting better, but actually it wasn't. I mean, the thing that we saw with Stephen Lawrence, the fact that, okay, we had a moment where there was an admission about structural racism and institutional racism. We're actually in a much worse place. And I'm worried that I see a generation growing up that's got this very kind of internalized Islamophobia, to put it kind of bluntly. You know, they're not, obviously they don't think of themselves as Islamophobes. I'm not saying that they are kind of going around hating on Muslims, but there's a kind of sense, like you said, that, you know, we have to be good, we have to prove ourselves, we have to show ourselves. It's a self-defeating exercise. Actually, the project that we recently were working with the University of Leeds, particularly in the United Kingdom report, but also in some of the other reports, Germany and France and so on, this was a kind of ongoing critique, actually, that, you know, when are we going to break out of this? When are we going to realise that it's not about us proving how good we are? It's about equality and how that applies to everybody, and why is there that conditionality on us?
There's also you could call it almost like a new phenomenon, which is, we know about the far right, we know about their anti-Islamophobic nature and whatever else, but I think, and this was actually said at a stand-up gig by Omar Hamdi, just a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about the far left, and like the, not the far left, but you know, the sort of elitist left, the liberals who think and believe that we're kind of not as good as them, and that we need liberating and saving, and that they're there to kind of, you know, support us because we need that support. And I think, you know, we have a big part to play in that, in terms of we haven't shown ourselves to be strong enough to be able to stand on our own 2 feet. So people think they need to liberate us, and they need to support us, and they need to help us. But intrinsically, because of the way that I think Islam is portrayed, and because of the way that Muslims are portrayed, and everything that people see and consume, they whether they support us as, you know, in our right to exist and our right to be, I think there still is that inherent othering.
It's a white saviour complex, essentially.
White saviour complex. And I think we're also a bit blindsided that we don't really see that's happening a lot. So a lot of the people that we see as like supporting us are really kind of supporting our right to exist, but still think that we're beneath them. Might be a bit harsh to say, but...
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we don't want to kind of generalise. We know we've got quite a lot of good allies, but unfortunately, yes, that is a trend, and it's part of the same cultural myopia that we live in, which is, you know, ultimately, you are an other. There are some conditions around you, not really, you know, quite part of us.
Yeah.
And that does need addressing, and it's across the board. And I think in many ways there's a conversation right now about the, you know, the rise of the far right across Europe, but actually that is an outcome of things like Islamophobia and structural racism and institutional racism. It's not the cause of it, actually. Yeah. The cause is within the institutions. You know, if we're not going to have a culture change in the media, if politicians are going to keep on going on and on speaking the way they do about Muslims, if the laws that are enacted, you know, these all feed into each other, are going to, you know, either explicitly or implicitly target Muslims and criminalize them, or indeed other otherized people, then that's what the ordinary person on the street is going to actually internalize and believe. And, you know, some of those people who are also very disenfranchised are going to get dragged into the far right movements. But that is not the cause of the problem. That's one of the symptoms.
Yeah, it's a lot to process. I think one of the interesting things that you guys have done over the last few years to almost address this quite head on, very boldly and bravely, I might add as well, is the Islamophobia Awards. And this is an award ceremony. I remember the first time I saw it, I was extremely confused because I thought I'd misread it. I didn't know what was going on. It was the Islamophobia Awards. And I guess what you do there is you celebrate the biggest Islamophobes of the year. And I think it's great. It's great. I was there 3 years ago, I think. And it was a very odd atmosphere in that there was kind of a celebration, but obviously what we're celebrating is Islamophobia. it was I don't know how to articulate it, but it was an interesting experience. And what's the reception been to the awards?
Okay, so the awards, you see, they've got an importance beyond what they were originally meant to, in a way. But actually, it's been overall a kind of positive experience. I was actually also one of the naysayers when it came to organising this.
So basically, any ideas that IHRC have...
And I say no, turn out to be the good
turn
ones.
Turn out to be the good ones, okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's a good... At least you know now how to...
Yeah, you know, when something's going to be good is when I'm annoyed about it. But seriously, though... It was essentially the kind of skit around which to hang our fundraising event. At that time, we were fundraising to try and get offices. We started this first time in 2003. And from years back, I mean, before we started IHRC, actually, some of those of us who were founders were kind of having a joke about this, that, you know, we should give awards for the worst Islamophobes, going back sort of from the time of the Rushdie affair, really. And somehow this kind of took a life of its own, and, you know, I wanted it to have some kind of flashy name, etc., etc. It was kind of inspired in a way by the Secret Policeman's Ball, which was the fundraiser for Amnesty International. But somehow it just ended up with the kind of crude name of the Islamophobia Awards. But that in itself kind of also worked because it sort of does what it says on the tin. Okay?
Yeah.
And that aspect of just having a laugh, you know, I think one of the years I wrote the strapline. It was my fault that sometimes all you can do is laugh. You know, it's kind of like, you know, in space, no one can hear you scream with alien. This was the sort of the reverse of that, it's quite cathartic. You know, being a victim of racism is psychologically very damaging, and actually sometimes when you can just, you know, take the mic, it helps.
Yeah.
But beyond that, you know, then again it became about Muslims taking control of the narrative, Muslims not kind of going cap in hand, going, oh, please don't be nasty to me, you know, don't be racist type of thing. And so it's had all sorts of kind of effects, and it's actually upset probably all the right people it needed to upset in terms of the worst Islamophobes. I mean, some of them recently have kind of decided to oddly get into the spirit of things and ask some of their followers on Twitter to vote for them, etc., like Douglas Murray and so on. But still doesn't win, funny enough. But, you know.
But the state of being an Islamophobe, I think, is definitely slowly being normalised. And it's almost like, amongst the right, it's a badge of honour.
Absolutely.
Which is worrying, because I think when you guys started out, to call someone an Islamophobe was to call them a racist. And no one wants to be called a racist. Well, again, even that's suddenly becoming...
Well, that's the thing. Islamophobia is normalised. As you said, it's completely normalised. And it is becoming a badge of honour. And you can just turn around and say the most outrageous stuff and say, well, you know, it's okay because it's about Muslims. But off of the back of that, particularly in the United Kingdom context, a lot of the quote-unquote old racisms, the biological racisms, which had slowly become more taboo, have resurfaced, including anti-Semitism, including anti-black racism and other types of racism. And it's really alarming. We saw it after Brexit. And again, there was a connection between the legitimisation of Islamophobia and then the legitimisation of all other types of racism. I mean, you know, the prime victims after that of hate crime, and there was such a huge spike in hate crime that even the Metropolitan Police had to say, this is because of Brexit, were people of Eastern European origin.
Yeah.
You know, are white-skinned people. But that culture of, you know, we're British versus the Muslims, which is a kind of meaningless dichotomy. I mean, if you can't define what is British if you actually asked a person who might be kind of saying, well, I'm British, I'm not a Muslim.
Mm.
They couldn't pin something down.
But I think also one of the issues almost is that when you look at the demographics of Muslims in the UK, I think a large majority are from a sort of, are basically brown, pretty much. Yeah. And so what's happened is that kind of the influx of immigrants from India and from East Africa and wherever else in the 80s and 90s and earlier, the climate, for me at least, the climate of what's been happening in foreign policy and around the world and everywhere else, it's almost like a natural progression where, okay, fine, we can't be racist anymore, but we can still pick on the Muslims because they're kind of responsible. And I think that again, that sentiment just hasn't died in terms of people feeling threatened by people coming from outside. And I think it's almost legitimate to an extent, where you are going to fit. If in my office today suddenly like five people decide, okay, we're going to start working here, like you don't know what's going on, right? There's that element to it. But I think it's tough. I mean, how we reconcile all of this. And also, I mean, the problem is we can't just start afresh today. We've got to look at history, and we've got to understand the social conditions that people are in. And again, I think a lot of that we can almost ascribe to poor government policy. Like today, the fact that the NHS is failing, the fact that a lot of the public services that we have no longer operate how they used to, you're looking for someone to blame. And when you see that there's been an influx of Eastern Europeans or Europeans generally, you can say, well, they're putting the squeeze on everything, aren't they?
This is it. But I think we find it very hard to kind of hold government accountable for the type of values that, or lack of values that are permeating society. Yeah. And I think it's quite odd that, you know, in westernised context, we don't hold the governments responsible. But then we use that westernised gaze to then criticise all these countries around the world
for having,
you know, this, that, the other type of government and controlling and blah, 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 blah. And even those, even in some of the extreme cases, are not even kind of legitimate critiques. But, you know, if you can do that, then surely at least you can turn the lens this way as well. And I think that's the thing. You hit upon the fact that, you know, it's fear, it's this, it's that. One of the things my colleague, Professor Armley, taught me over the last 20 years, I mean, I'm the head of research, but he's actually the kind of the director of the academic content that we put out, is, and he came up with this, and at the time I was, again, very resistant, but I was quickly sold, was the idea that actually, you know, when you have perpetrators of Islamophobic acts of violence, hatred, and so on and so forth, those individuals in a way are also victims of Islamophobia. they've just internalized what the institutions are kind of churning out as a message. Yeah. I mean, obviously it's not the same to say the person that kind of hit you or killed you or whatever is the same as you, but yeah. 9 times out of 10, these are not card-carrying racists. They're not affiliated to some kind of nefarious organization. They're quote-unquote ordinary people. So we have to kind of understand that. For the recent work on counter-narratives that we did, we interviewed, as you know, quite a lot of people, including yourself, in terms of what are counter-narratives. And Arun Kunani is a professor of media. He used to be based in the UK, is now in New York. Really kind of hit the nail on the head. He said, you know, Islamophobia points to the wider crisis in British society and in westernised societies. You know, things are crumbling, things are falling apart, and this is a facet of it, and we have to understand it in that wider context. As you just said, the fact that the NHS is falling to pieces, the fact that people are terrified for their jobs, you know, we're living in an age of austerity. These things are intertwined, and, you know, it's not a case of Muslim rights versus somebody else's rights.
Yeah.
We have to understand that it's part of the same phenomenon. We need to get to a resolution that helps everybody.
Yeah, no, for sure. The last question I wanted to ask you is actually completely on a bit of a tangent.
Okay.
There's no easy segue. I was thinking I'll find out. I just can't, so I'm just going to come up with it. And it's regarding the Quds Day protests that take place every year. Now, last year, as you're obviously well aware, Darren Osborne attempted to drive down to London, and he was targeting the Quds Day rally or protest, whatever you want to call it. And it's something that's been spoken about by the likes of Majid Nawaz on LBC at length. And I've heard him, I think the day before this happened last year, I heard him talking about it and was basically saying it needs to be shut down. You know, it's anti-Semitic. It's whatever. The fact that they fly Hezbollah flags is obviously a huge area of contention as well. Now, IHRC, I think, an instrumental organisation in organising this every year. And growing up, I've been to Palestine-based protests, and I genuinely thought that IHRC, this is when I was very young, were like the sort of poster boys for the Palestine cause, because I would always see IHRC placards and signs everywhere. And I just thought that you were the only organisation that actually cared about Palestine, because you were the only ones I saw like doing it all the time. And I'm sure you were against.
I'll pay you later.
I'm sure you were against the placards, because they were very effective.
I may have designed a few.
But yeah, so I think what I'm asking here is an understanding of the situation regarding, for example, the Hezbollah flags. Number one, is it illegal? Because I think the Sadiq Khan wrote a letter to try and stop them.
Sadiq Khan has been a bit weird about the whole thing. Yeah, he's been saying one thing to one group of people and one thing to another group of people. You can follow all the correspondence on our website. Actually, there are days when I can't keep up with it myself, because he seems to, you know, swing between whether he's appeasing pro-Israel groups or telling us he believes in freedom of speech. He can't quite make his mind up.
But what's the situation like? Why is it? I mean, Hezbollah are a terrorist organization according to the UK
government. No, their military wing is proscribed, but their political wing is not. And
what's the difference between the two?
Well, obviously they're a parliamentary party and they take part in elections and they are represented across Lebanon. So they're a legitimate political player.
Okay.
And at one point, you know, we're even in sort of coalitions, etc. in terms of
And how is that Hezbollah linked to the military wing?
Well, they're not linked, and that's the thing. And so flying the flag, there is advice on our website. It's not currently illegal in this country, but then all sorts of things happen in this country which are quite unfair. So, you know, monitor the situation. We don't, as an organisation, fly those flags, but we don't have a problem because it's not illegal and because it is very symbolic for a lot of people with regard to Palestine.
Mm.
The sort of pushback against Israeli expansionism and human rights abuses is, you know, very much linked to the kind of effective resistance of Hezbollah amongst other players, right? So that's been there for a long time at Quds Day. I think we have to remember that Quds Day has been around for over 30 years, and if, you know, people who have come to that demonstration know it's, you know, full of families, people come with, you know, kids in prams and things. For a long time now, it's had a huge Jewish presence in it as well, both religious Jews, secular Jews, you know, left-wing activists, etc. So there's a huge diversity of people who are on board with Quds Day. And so for the last couple of years, we've been getting kind of very targeted campaigns against it by essentially pro-Zionist, pro-Israeli Zionist groups.
And it takes place, if I'm not mistaken, on the last Friday of Ramadan.
That's the worldwide date. In the UK, sometimes we have it on the Friday, sometimes we have it on the Sunday. Here's the plug, it's 10th of June this year, the Sunday.
Fair enough. And are you concerned?
We're always concerned. Obviously, after last year, you're more concerned. But it's, one thing I have to say is that with Quds Day, the Metropolitan Police have always been very good and very supportive. And it's one of the ironies that IHRC has always been sort of very critical of police institutions in terms of
their
record. But at the same time, we will acknowledge that on this issue, they've been absolutely excellent. That's not to say they might not be excellent, but, certainly last year, the reason that Dan Osborne couldn't target Quds Day was because of there being a police cordon. There'd been sort of low-level harassment by kind of far-right and Zionist groups over a number of years, probably going back to about the end of the noughties. But last year, I think, and you mentioned Majid Nawaz, and I think this is a really important point about, it kind of demonstrates what we were talking about directly before, about how demonization works and how, people are incited to do things. And I think there was so much last year hype by particular kind of Zionist press, not even the totality of certain pro-Israeli kind of papers, just a few.
Yeah.
Also Majid Nawaz and also Tommy Robinson. And there was even crossover between some of those. Some and all of which were somehow accessed by Darren Osborne, who in his particular frame of mind then decided to take action. He felt impelled to kind of do that.
Mm.
I'm sure, and I think it's quite clear that, he couldn't give a coherent reason why he was doing any of this. But that's the case with so many acts of political violence.
I think what I find very frustrating about this is that looking at the likes of Majid Nawaz, Tommy Robinson, and as you say, that's the narrative he bought into, which led him to terrorism. Very plainly, and I don't think that's unfair to say.
Absolutely.
Yet, when we have Muslims looking at content which leads them to terrorism, those groups are very rightly so blacklisted, called terrorist groups, ISIS, we know what the policy is on things like ISIS, and no one has any issues with that. Yet still, up until very recently, Tommy Robinson was on Twitter.
Yeah.
His account got taken down. I'm not actually too sure why. I'm sure it's related to breaches in their policy. But it's taken them over a year after someone went and killed somebody off the back of things that he has said to actually act. And that really concerns me because, as you say, and why I genuinely am concerned for like the Quds Day protest this year is that it has been targeted in the past. I personally have seen what I've been in previous years, as you mentioned, far-right groups along with Zionist groups there who are quite aggressively shouting.
Well, you heard the chants last year. I mean, they were absolutely appalling. I mean, I can't repeat them on here. Find them on our website.
Yeah.
I mean, and really very threatening behaviour. And yet, nobody wants to really kind of give that the attention that it deserves, okay? And if anything, then you want to promote this as this kind of ridiculous demonisation of the event. And it's obviously upsetting, but if this is what we're going through in London, imagine what it's like in Palestine. I think that's the thing. People, the really enduring thing about Quds Day is I think probably the only really proactive demonstration for Palestine. We're always out on the streets when something happens, some particular extreme moment has happened. But actually the whole of that situation is unjust day in, day out. And the fact that at least, even if it's just once a year, people around the world are coming out to highlight that. Forget about London. I mean, people come out in their hundreds of thousands in Kashmir for Quds Day. And, they call it Quds and Kashmir Day because they see the kind of connection between that kind of militarized oppression that then both peoples are going through.
It might be a conversation for another podcast, but I'll be perfectly honest. The last few years, well, quite a while now, I haven't been to protests, street protests, simply because I see them as beyond the element of self-discipline in terms of giving up your personal time for a cause, which I think is a good exercise in terms of at least acknowledging within yourself that you care about this. I don't see the impact that can be had with street protests. So why would you encourage people to attend? What's the purpose? Well, why should I come this year?
So, you know, as a Muslim, first of all, we know the hadith that if you see something wrong, in unjust, change it with your hand if you can't. Speak out against it if you can't, at least hate it in your heart. Okay, so the street protests, they're somewhere within that kind of nexus. And ultimately, we have to do whatever we can, and the rest is in the hands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Sometimes we kind of confuse the ends and the means, right? We'll do whatever we need to get to, we think, to get to a certain end. Sometimes we just have to have the right means. And right now, I think, particularly Quds Day, because it is proactive, because that space is being demonized, which kind of by the all the people that, you know, we know to be racist and, you know, voices of injustice. This is a moment when actually we have to support it a little bit more. Of course, everybody's going to have concerns. This is not if you don't come, there's something wrong with you. But definitely, I don't think this is something to give up on. If anything, I think this is the time right now when it's difficult to come out and show your support. Because, you know, as I said, if this is what it's like in London, what is going on elsewhere? What is going on at the heart of the problem in Palestine? So, you know, we have to just push ourselves a little bit more. Yeah, I know it's frustrating. I also don't go to that many demos, but I do make sure I go to Thursday. I don't go to so many anymore because I think we're stuck in a cycle of responding every time something happens. Actually, we need to mobilize proactively.
But this is the thing. So, like, when the Iraq war happened and 2 million people took to the streets, I was there. Yeah. I'm sure you were there as well.
I just had a baby, so I wasn't there.
Okay,
so,
you should have been there. That's understandable. But I, you know, 2 million people,
yeah,
the largest protest in UK's history, didn't change a thing.
No, I know. 500,000 people came out for the Rushdie affair, and you could say that didn't change a thing either. But actually, I think when you look back historically, these things would have had a major impact. What if that hadn't happened? Certainly, I think in the United Kingdom, if we hadn't had the kind of mobilisation we'd had against the satanic verses, I think our situation in terms of civil and political rights would be much, much worse. Much worse. I think we'd be living in a state like people are in France, where they're completely oppressed in terms of their identity as Muslims. It's not to say that things are going in the right direction here now. I think they're going back massively.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes if you just don't stand up and say, this is who I am and I'm upset, and if you don't get it, well, you know, maybe try. You don't have to agree with me, but you're going to have to try and get into this mindset. I think that's absolutely essential. And whether it's about Islamophobia or any type of injustice, you know, you have to let people be themselves.
Yeah.
Right?
No, of course. And I guess just to finish, how can people get involved with IHRC? What do you need from people, if anything? Where can they find you and everything else?
Well, first of all, we, as everybody else, need du'as. keep us on the right path and keep us going. But, you know, beyond that, there are many ways you can get involved. You can volunteer, you know, even if you don't live nearby, you can do it virtually, etc. Just contact us via our website. It's ihrc.org.uk. We're on all the social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc. However you want to get hold of us, get hold of us. You know, of course, give us your money if you can, but give us your time and give us your prayers. And give us your ideas. I think that's one of the things we didn't really touch upon, but, you know, everybody needs to be told where they're going right and going wrong, or what they need to refocus on. And we do try and do that, albeit imperfectly, but, you know.
And I guess you know on your end as well that if people come forward with an idea and you don't like it, then it's probably a winner. Right?
I deserve that, absolutely.
No, it's brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your kind of experience over the last 21 years with IHRC. It's actually been a bit of a lesson for me in terms of understanding policy and the climate, I guess, when I was very young in the UK. And then also just learning from your experiences working in this field for the amount of time you have. And I think what I've observed over the last 3 or 4 years is that when you're kind of in this space constantly, you start to see things and you start to understand correlations between the way things are happening, looking at things like policy and violence on the streets and Islamophobia and everything that you mentioned. I can fully appreciate, because just the limited time that I've been there, I've been able to see it a little bit, and I can't imagine what 20 plus years of experience off that gives you in terms of wisdom and insight and really understanding and grasping what the situation is. So I think with the history that you guys have, you definitely are in a good place in terms of steering the organisation in the right direction, and I guess being able to look at Islamophobia as a whole and understanding where we're going as society. I don't know if that was a compliment or just a comment. I don't know what that was, but it's...
I'll take it as a compliment. Yeah. Take what I can get. But thank you for having me on. And I mean, I think I talked a lot about the UK, which actually one of the ironies, it's never been our sole focus. I mean, indeed, neither is Islamophobia. Mm. But it intersects with all the other things that we work on, whether they're quote-unquote international or anti-racism or anti-austerity or poverty, etc.
We could probably do this again. Like, I got an email from IHRC about Nigeria, yes, about Sheikh Zakzaki.
Yeah.
Who you mentioned earlier on as well, and we could probably talk about that at length, and I'd love to understand more about the situation out there. And you guys are only down the road, so we should definitely do this again sometime.
Absolutely.
That's brilliant. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and hope to see this again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Cool. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you very much to our listeners for joining us. If you enjoyed this podcast, please be sure to subscribe. And if you're feeling extra generous, feel free to give us a 5-star rating as well. You can connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Muslim Vibe, and join in the conversation using hashtag TMV Podcast. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wahed helps you become a halal investor in minutes. Clients from over 40 states have already started their journey with us. Here's how it works. First, we ask you 8 simple questions to recommend a portfolio based on your risk profile. You then select your portfolio and simply sign up online. Your account can be approved in seconds. After you fund your account, we'll place the trades for you. All you have to do then is sit back and monitor your performance. It actually is that easy.